Some of the incidents you don't hear about are the ones that are not these big sweeping stories like the Carol Swain story or the dog poop story, but the incidents that kind of internalize a narrative in the eyes of the students. I would say the biggest example of this was right after the election. There were emails sent out to students basically offering up grief spaces, safe spaces for students. If anyone needed counseling after the election, school would provide that for them. And I had extra credit given to me to go attend a giant walkout and protest against Donald Trump, which was taking place on campus. When the administration sends out an email after the election saying that they're going to set up grieving spaces for the results of the election, it lets people know who voted for Trump that the school thinks they're wrong, that the school doesn't think there's a place for them there. Because I have absolutely no doubt in my mind that if Hillary Clinton had won the election, there would have been no classes canceled, there would have been no tests postponed, there would have been no grief spaces, there would have been no Play-Doh and sharing your feelings or any of these things. School would have continued as normal.
Before we move on, just to clarify, you mentioned extra credit. So engaging in left-wing activism helped your grade. Did I hear that correctly?
Yes.
Noted.
Making a living the old hard way. Taking and giving my day by day. I dig snow and rain and a bright sunshine. Taking the land.
Hey, everybody, this is Brett. Welcome back to School Sucks. Today's April 3rd. What's up with that voice? It's allergy season here in New England. I am working on it. I got my humidifier running. I put a little rosemary oil in there. I also gargled with some salt water. I'm doing all the right things. You know, I don't know how it is where you live, but if you want to go to the pharmacy and buy some of that Zyrtec or Claritin, oh, they make you show your ID because people use it to make meth. In other news, I have been out and about scouting venues for our big event this summer, a School Sucks Project and Renegade University present a weekend with Thaddeus Russell that's happening the first week in August. I haven't found anything yet that really blew my mind, but I'm going scouting again this coming weekend. Next stop, my old stomping ground, Salem, Massachusetts, a very historic little town with lots of great fad themes. Shame, alienation, puritanism. What a place. So I'm going to check that out this weekend. If you live in the greater Boston area, don't hesitate to PM me. I might like to get your input. So I told you in an earlier show what happened with Harvard. Those people are out of their minds in every way, apparently. They wanted 10,000. Maybe they looked at who we were and they said, let's charge them $65 an hour for men's room attendance and then see what they do. I don't know. That actually reminds me, if I feel up to it, I'm thinking about taking a trip down to Yale University. Have you heard about this place? Tomorrow to see Tom Woods. So if you're in the Connecticut, Rhode Island area, I just want to let you know Tom is going to be there. Check his website, tomwoods.com, for details. And I would love to do more cool stuff like that, but it involves, gas, pretty much taking the day off from work, parking, meals, ransom money in case there's a kidnapping. That's not a good area, by the way, that Yale is in, New Haven, Connecticut. And I went down there. I went to a tutoring seminar years ago, and I just figured, apparently very naively, this is the home of Yale. This is like a George H.W. Bush kind of town. Lots of people with underbites walking around going, Apparently not. So I just parked, anywhere. And then I was wandering through the city at like 1 o'clock in the morning looking for my car. I had no idea that I could have been mugged because later when I told people, I went down to Yale. They said, you went into New Haven, Connecticut? It's so bad there. I didn't know. So I'm thinking about going down there again tomorrow. And you can't bring a gun in those parts, I'll tell you what. So I'll probably just have to get by with my old swamp lizard pocket knife. So yeah, a lot on the line, I guess, is my point. And if you're sitting there listening to this story with a tear in your eye saying, God, Brett, how could I incentivize you to, courageously trek into some of these gangster-ass cities like New Haven, Connecticut, I'll tell you what you can do. We have a Patreon page. We're very close to reaching our first Patreon goal, which is $100 per content item. You can learn more about that. There's a link right in the show notes, but the website is patreon.com/schoolsucks. The most recent addition for patrons only was a conversation that I had with Steve Patterson, where we discussed what his approach would be to debating Thaddeus Russell, primarily on the topic of objective reality. But the conversation went in a lot of different directions, and the feedback has been great so far. So I highly recommend you grant yourself access to that. You can do it immediately. But what's happening in the podcast today? I want to say it's something new, but it's actually the second installment of an ongoing series similar to the school news series we used to do. It's called Campus Correspondence. So on this show today, I'm going to talk to Sam Wolf. He is a freshman at Vanderbilt University. He's studying political science. He is the soon-to-be president of the College Republicans. And you'll hear me say to Sam, this is the first time I'm having one of these conversations, but that's not really accurate. It's the second time. It was actually Biffa with whom we started our college correspondence up at the University of Toronto. So the way this is going to work, when a college is beset by controversy and strife, I'm going to talk to a student from that school so we can have our own eyes and ears in some of these hostile settings. Berkeley is a school that we're working on for the future. And I'm always happy to take your suggestions for college correspondence in the group. All right. That's it, everybody. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll talk to you again soon. So my guest on the show today is Sam Wolf. Hi, Sam.
How's it going?
It's going well. Sam is a freshman at Vanderbilt University. For those of you who don't know, Vanderbilt University is a private research university. It's in Nashville, Tennessee. What do you got there, Sam? About 12,000 students?
There's about 7,000 undergrads and about 6,000 graduate students.
And Vanderbilt is consistently ranked in the top 50 schools in the country, so it's a fairly prestigious institution. And as I said, Sam is a freshman, and he is a member of the Vanderbilt College Republicans. So I was just saying to you, Sam, before we started, that I'm interested in developing more of a correspondence with people in your position, people who are enduring a lot of the frustrations or even some of the conflicts with the left on your campus, whether it's student activists or even faculty members. And, you know, I've watched for a couple of years now a lot of what's been going on all the way in higher education, like all the way back to Yale, the Halloween costume fiasco at the end of 2015. And of course, I've seen what has happened at Berkeley and the University of Toronto with Jordan Peterson. And I think for me and a lot of my audience, a lot of this just seems really abstract, right? It seems like kind of borderline unbelievable. So I'm hoping that conversations with people like you — this is the first one of these that I've ever done, by the way, and this is going to be an ongoing series on my show — we can move from abstract to real. So I thought we could start just by getting to know you a little bit, and you can tell me a little bit about how you came to Vanderbilt, what you're there to study, and why you joined the College Republicans.
So I come from the San Francisco Bay Area. I grew up there. I'm studying political science and history at Vanderbilt, likely to go on to law school. And I joined the College Republicans because, as long as I can remember, as soon as I came of age politically, I've been more conservative. And I grew up in the Bay Area, which is notoriously probably the most liberal place in the entire country. And so from basically right when I got started with politics, I was forced to be on the defense. I was exposed. All the craziness you hear about in college campuses was basically going on in my high school campuses. So I had to deal with name-calling, labeling, people, you know, disliking, just getting angry at me for my views, liberal teachers and professors – So in high school, I started an organization called the Golden State Teenage Conservatives, where we worked to organize high school students that are on the right in the Bay Area to come together and, you know, let people know that, number one, you know, there's nothing wrong with you if you have a different point of view, as much as the left would like you to think that there is. Mm-hmm. Two, that, you know, the only way for change to actually happen is to organize, come together, and create a unified voice on the right that says we exist, we have our own voices, and that it's okay for people to come join us. And so then when I went to Vanderbilt, I had found my passion for politics in high school, and I just wanted to continue that. So I joined the College Republicans and have been heavily involved in all, you know, activism on the right since I got to campus.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. You know, one of the things that we've talked about on my show since the beginning is, you know, school as a force for indoctrination. And a lot of people leave high school very oriented towards the left, for sure. And then college, you know, so what I've said before is that a high school produces in a lot of people a kind of philosophical and political apathy. So because of so much of our culture is anti-conservative, anti-libertarian, it is very much left-wing politics integrated into news and entertainment, Hollywood. So people who have this kind of political apathy, as they grow up, they just sort of drift that way, as if it's the only rational way to think, like what Jon Stewart thinks. You know, and then you get to college, of course, and it's like being shot out of a cannon towards the left, depending on your program of study. If you're doing like political science like yourself or some other soft social science, that's definitely going to happen. What do you think were the influences in your life that helped you resist going that way, or maybe waking up to some of what was happening, you know, as far as like the direction you felt you were being pushed politically in high school? And then even, I guess, the same would be true in college.
It's honestly hard to pinpoint for me. I'm a little bit of an enigma in the sense that my family is very liberal. I'm Jewish kid from San Francisco. It's hard to get a more liberal stereotype than that. Mm-hmm. I've just kind of always from the beginning just heard the facts as they were presented. I would say maybe in my middle school history class, learning about Ronald Reagan, doing pro-Israel and Zionist activity and seeing kind of a lot of the lunacy on the left with regards to that, just kind of always struck me, you know, to bend towards the right. And then a lot of it was reading philosophy, reading people like Ben Shapiro, like Milton Friedman, supply-side economics thinkers. And I think that honestly the best guard against leftist indoctrination is simply just presenting the ideas of the right and just presenting the facts as they are. But the problem is in universities, high schools as well, you just don't get an opportunity to hear both sides. I think what you were saying is kind of hits the nail on the head of why people don't often, you know, appreciate what conservatives have to go through, or they kind of scoff at it, is liberalism and leftism is the default. So when conservatives complain about bias, you know, most people will look at it and say, oh, this is just how it is. This is not biased. But they don't understand is that for everything that is being shoved down our throats, for all the, you know, Howard Zinn's we have to read in class, they're not giving us Hayek to read. They're not giving us Mises to read. They're not giving us Ayn Rand to read. That just doesn't exist. There's no attempt to actually, you know, explain these ideas and teach them as legitimate, because the default is what has become, you know, a Marxist leftist ideology that's being taught.
Yeah, absolutely. So you mentioned Ben Shapiro, and he's been one of the guys who said things like, look, if you think like me and you're in one of these programs as a student, shut up, you know, like keep your head down. He's, you know, he talks about the blue books that he used to hand in, where he would write like a Marxist just to get through and get himself into law school. So similar kind of track to what you're on. Have you tried to speak up or to assert yourself in the political science program that you're in so far? And if so, what have the results been?
I would say that my philosophy is speak my mind, but write like a Marxist.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I definitely, on all my papers and tests that I hand in, I basically write down whatever the teacher wants me to write, because in the end, I know that the professor's giving you your grade, and he doesn't really care if you're right or not. He cares if you say what he wants you to say.
Right.
So an example, in my intro to psychology class, there was for some reason a question about interpreting the insanity of Donald Trump. I don't know why a psychology class is starting to get political, but I basically wrote about how Trump is crazy, about how he's, you know, there's using confirmation bias, denying climate change, basically all the troves that the left wants you to hear, even though I didn't agree with any of it. And I ended up getting, you know, a good grade on that test, even though I didn't believe anything. But in class, I make sure to, if the professor is saying something, you know, to the left, I always make sure to challenge him. Because what I'm worried about is not people like me coming in here and having to deal with leftist professors, because people who have an established worldview have been exposed to the idiots opposite, kind of have that the shield to defend against it.
Sure.
I'm worried about, you know, the apathetic people who listen to a class, people who aren't very politically involved. And college, I mean, I've noticed since being here, it really does shape your worldview. And if you come in with a blank slate, which a lot of people do, I think Vanderbilt's not the most political campus in the country. A lot of people are here to study other things, and they come in with that political and philosophical blank slate. And then if all they hear is piled on leftist trope after leftist trope, and they don't hear anyone opposing it, if they don't, you know, have someone as an example to say, look, there's other things, there's other ideas, then they're going to subscribe to this default position, and they're not going to have the opportunity to hear other ideas. And they're going to go on whatever field that they end up going into and be very successful at it. And then they're just going to come at it and think that the only default position, the only moral position, is the one on the left.
Yep.
And if they don't get that opposition, then they're never going to have a chance to explore other ideas or potentially have the tools to at least, if not, you know, reject the ideas, at least question the ideas from the professors and not take them as automatic truths.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, really well said. So let's talk about that in a little more detail. A lot of these political science classes that I guess you just completed in where are we in the year? It's March. So you've done what you're almost done with your second semester. The classes that you've been in so far, is there like a average size you could give just so people who are completely unfamiliar with Vanderbilt could maybe get a picture of?
It really ranges. My kind of intro economics psychology classes were around 150, 200 people. My political science classes were 30 to 50. I would say the average is somewhere between 20 and 50 students in a class. Some are smaller. Vanderbilt's not a huge state school.
Right.
So there's not, for the most part, beyond introductory courses, they're not huge lecture classes. It's a lot more discussion based, and it's a lot more interaction with the professor than
awesome.
You would get once you get out of the intro classes, at least.
Cool. So let's focus on those political science classes that you said were like 50 people or less. Anything particularly impactful so far from this year as far as, you know, you hearing something or enduring some kind of painful lecture and feeling compelled to speak up and what you said, what the issue was, what you said, and what kind of warm or not so warm response you got from the person at the front of the room?
Yeah, I think one of the most poignant examples was in a class I'm taking called The History of American Capitalism. It's going essentially on a timeline of how capitalism developed in America. And from the beginning, the first day of class, the professor said out front that capitalism exists because of slavery. Capitalism is slavery. We get down to the Civil War and the slaves era, and he's teaching us that basically slavery is an essential and, you know, fundamental part of capitalism. And I obviously take issue with that because I don't think philosophically that's accurate. I think it's misrepresenting misrepresenting the ideology of what capitalism is, the benefits of capitalism is driven. And I did argue with the professor. I questioned his logic, said that, you know, what I was worried about is, like I was saying before, that people like me who have had exposure to the ideologies of Austrian economics, who have exposure to free market thinkers, are going to come into that. We're going to see this is another perspective, and we can weigh the two options. People who don't have that exposure are going to come into a class like that here. Capitalism is slavery. Capitalism is slavery. It's going to be reiterated, and that's going to kind of warm them up to these messages that you get from people like Bernie Sanders about the exploitation, about these other things, that if you paint the ideologies of the opposing side as associated with these, you know, obviously these words of exploitation, these words about slavery, you prime people up to accept these more extreme policy outcomes.
Yeah.
And so I think that it's important that people who come into a class like this, a history class, not just take the word of the professor at face value, because for, you know, every professor who teaches that capitalism and slavery, you know, there's a book out there describing how capitalism is the single greatest cure of poverty, how capitalism was the force that helped bring an end to slavery as opposed to a force that perpetuated it, how capitalism is the engine of economic growth that just created the prosperity in America. Those are the things that we're not talking about in class, and those are the things that I think people need to get an exposure to get a full picture of these ideas in American history, as opposed to just that one-sided perspective.
Yeah, absolutely. Because obviously capitalism is being presented as an undesirable alternative to, guess what, state socialism, I'm guessing, with most of these people, and you mentioned that. How history is just removed from the equation. Like, the 20th century told that story. I mean, there are certainly, you know, things that look like capitalism that are not. I was talking to an academic recently named Thaddeus Russell, and he's talking about this new buzzword on the left, the neoliberal university. I don't know if you've heard that term or not, but
that's the at least two or three of my classes have focused on this idea of neoliberalism. So it's definitely very prevalent.
Sure. So neoliberalism is kind of like, you know, taking the ideas of the Chicago school guys like Milton Friedman. And then those ideas, when you involve state power, they get perverted. So they got perverted in South America, where it became this kind of corporatism. The same thing happened in Southeast Asia when Bill Clinton was president. So these people are not being as necessarily as deceptive as it might seem from somebody who's read a lot of the Austrian school or Mises, because they call this like state corporate phenomenon capitalism, which
right.
It isn't. So, I mean, this is another problem, is that capitalism is never even really defined. I'm wondering, like, what kind of resources they even give you to develop an understanding of what capitalism is before they make these, historical or ideological claims about it being evil and a perpetuator of slavery.
Well, what they do is they create their own definitions of capitalism to serve their own arguments and their own purposes. The point you brought about South America, I think, is an excellent one. Another one of the classes I'm taking right now is a history of the drug trade in Latin America, and we spent a couple days on the idea of neoliberalism, and the message, the argument that was being presented by the professors was that the thing that drove South America into poverty, the thing that turned people towards the drug trade, that created this kind of the failed state environment that a lot of these countries have, was the free market ideas of Milton Friedman and neoliberalism. Never mind the fact that these countries were run by dictators, that, you know, people like Pinochet were nowhere near free market capitalists, they were nowhere near libertarian individualists who protected individual rights, nowhere near the actual philosophy of capitalism. By taking these things like this that have had bad historical outcomes, and slavery to a similar example, and putting that capitalism label onto it, what
right.
they're doing is they're telling their students who have not had an exposure to what free markets really are, what they're really all about, that these bad things are free markets. So when you have a conservative, a libertarian come in, a politician, and talk about the benefits of capitalism, the benefits of free markets, how it's the single greatest economic system ever to exist, these students, they hear that and they think they're advocating for slavery, they're advocating for genocide, they're advocating for dictators. And it's this mislabeling of these things without teaching the actual philosophy that create these deep-seated and ingrained biased perceptions that are really just the result of false definitions and not being exposed to the truth. And they get so ingrained that they begin to associate neoliberalism, classical liberalism, that's genocide, capitalism, that's slavery, no matter what the actual arguments are, because and tested to associate those two words together at the behest of the professors without hearing another opinion.
Yeah, absolutely. So really what they're talking about, like just to return to South America, is the application of something largely by a government in the case of, you know, United States history. And then they're kind of using that as an explanation of a whole belief system. Right.
Right.
When we're talking about a specific application. So, yeah, that works nicely for them. Before we move on, is there anything else that stuck out from the first year of school?
Academically, I would say that's kind of the biggest issue, is that subtle, unspoken bias. It's the apathetic kids coming in without having the tools to defend themselves or to understand and recognize the bias.
Right.
I would say the bigger problems and the more pressing issues I found have actually taken place outside of the classroom. They're with the administration. They're with the social nature of politics on campus. And they're with the student body as a whole, less so than the professors.
Yeah, absolutely. So the three stories that I know of that came from Vanderbilt in the last couple of years were the poop controversy, the bag of poop. That was one we could talk about. You can talk about whatever you want. I'll just tell you what I know. The name tags, the gender pronoun name tags. I don't know. Do you know about that?
I know that all the name tags for, you know, official positions, for student government, for orientation leaders, they all have pronouns labeled on them. We had to introduce – when I came to freshman orientation, we had to introduce ourselves using our pronouns. It's kind of just been accepted as the default nowadays, as well as all, you know, all gender, non-gender restrooms. That's everywhere. That's just kind of the way it is at this point.
Sure. And the other one that I know about is the controversy surrounding a professor, Dr. Carol Swain, who I guess is retiring or has already retired. When students demanded that she be censured for some of her opinions. But this is just what I can see online, you know, Googling Vanderbilt social problems. You're there. So let's start by talking about some of the big incidents and then just the general feel of that environment as you've experienced it.
I would say some of the incidents you don't hear about are the ones that are not these big sweeping stories like the Carol Swain story or the dog poop story, but the incidents that kind of internalize the narrative in the eyes of the students. So I would say the biggest example of this was right after the election. There were emails sent out to students basically offering up grief spaces, safe spaces for students. If anyone needed counseling after the election, school would provide that for them. I had class canceled the next day for people to, you know, take a day off to mourn. I had tests canceled, and I had extra credit given to me to go attend and support a giant walkout and protest against Donald Trump, which was taking place on campus. And all these subtle signs by the administration, basically, when the administration sends out an email after the election saying that, you know, after the result was determined, that they're going to set up grieving spaces for the results of the election, regardless of the fact that I'm sure at least 30 or 40% of the school voted for Donald Trump, what that does is it kind of puts people – it lets people know who voted for Trump that the school thinks they're wrong, that the school doesn't think there's a place for them there. Because I have absolutely no doubt in my mind that if Hillary Clinton had won the election, there would have been no classes canceled. There would have been no tests postponed. There would have been no grief spaces. There would have been no, you know, Play-Doh and sharing your feelings or any of these things. School would have continued as normal. And I think that really paints a really horrible image towards even the tacit conservatives on campus, because they see that, you know, what they believe in is just being outright rejected and that they're being taught there's not a place for them here.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, before we move on, just to clarify, you mentioned extra credit. So engaging in left-wing activism helped your grade. Did I hear that correctly?
Yes.
Noted. Okay, because that's something that we've been discussing, is activism being built into some of these programs. But I mean, I can only see what is edited down and put on YouTube from a lot of these colleges. But the impression that I get is a lot of this is just theater, right? It is like outrage theater, outrage victimization theater.
I think that's very accurate. And I think that it is only the people, at least at Vanderbilt, I'm not sure if it's the same at other schools, especially some of the more left-wing schools, you have this small but extremely vocal minority of activists who do not represent the majority of Vanderbilt students, but they have extremely loud voices. So they come and stage these huge walkouts and protests. They get riled up about, you know, sanctuary campus issues. They propose these things to the administration to stifle free thought and to promote the leftist agenda. And it's not a large percentage of the student body. But what they do with their loud voices is, because conservatives are not as loud, conservatives are not as vocal, they create a much bigger aura than they actually have and a much bigger presence than they actually are.
Yeah.
And they create this sort of air of leftism that just kind of filters through everything, that if you want to be – they create the perception that if you want to be an accepted Vanderbilt student, if you want to, you know, fit in to the school, you have to subscribe to these ideas and philosophies. And I think that the single biggest issue here, and probably at colleges in general, is not an administrative crackdown on free speech. It's not professors indoctrinating, but it's this unspoken social alienation and stigma. And I think it's the single biggest thing that is shutting conservatives up, is that they fear that if they come out and admit the fact that they voted for Donald Trump, if they, you know, admit the fact that they might be a Republican, that they're going to face social alienation. And for college students, that's the single biggest driver of actions, I would say, is, you know, for most people, it's, how is this going to impact my social life? You know, am I going to be able to get into the top club on campus, the top fraternity, if I come out as a Republican? Am I going to be able to, you know, have the friends that I want to have if I come out with my ideology? And they make the determination that it's more important to them to maintain their social status than to maintain their philosophies. And so they just remain silent. They don't come out and speak. They don't feel like there's a place for them on this campus. And they basically say, I'm just, you know, I agree with what you have to say, but I'm too scared to come out and say it myself. I don't want to risk my social capital by coming out as a Republican. And that's the single biggest thing that's silencing people. And I think that's the biggest issue on campuses.
Yeah, you don't even necessarily have to come out as a Republican, probably. But you're risking social capital even coming out against the prevailing narrative on the campus.
Right.
Right. So what I'm seeing is that there's this dynamic, right? There's people like you who do care and do organize, but you're small, and the other side is also relatively small, but they have much louder voices because that's much more acceptable in that environment. They also have faculty backing. They also have, you know, outside influences like mainstream media, or, you know, all of these faux comedians who are really just doing political commentary and just putting this thin veneer of humor on it, you know, the John Olivers of the world. So they're emboldened by that, and they're small numbers, but because they're so vocal and they have this backing, they have this emboldening, they kind of set the tone for the whole university. But meanwhile, you have this huge silent majority that is basically split between, you know, maybe not perfectly split, but between people who are primarily just apathetic. And I would argue that a lot of that comes out of training in public school. And then maybe another portion of that majority is, as you said, apprehensive about speaking out because they just kind of want to, you know, maintain access to the social benefits. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think that's definitely accurate. I mean, with Vanderbilt especially, Vanderbilt's undoubtedly a very liberal school, but it still is a Southern institution. It's changing a lot, but it's still, you know, if you compare Vanderbilt to Berkeley or Columbia, I would say the student body is significantly more conservative here, but it doesn't feel that way. for a lot of people. Especially, it doesn't feel that way for me, because I know that if I had to guess, I would say 30-40% probably voted for Trump on this campus. Maybe 5% or less have come out and said that they voted for Trump on this campus. Mm-hmm. And I think that huge disparity comes from it's very tacit. You know, you're sitting around in a dorm room, you're watching John Oliver, you have a conservative student there who may be uncomfortable with that. They're not going to come out and speak their opinion, because they know that, you know, being conservative in the eyes of most students here makes you a racist. It makes you a homophobe. It makes you an Islamophobe. It makes you all of these things that it makes you a bad person, really. And they don't want to risk that alienation by coming out and saying what they think. Prime examples of this are, you know, a friend of mine was walking around campus wearing a Make America Great Again hat after the election. He got dirty looks and insults all day. The day after the election, another friend of mine was actually wearing a College Republicans t-shirt and got verbally assaulted on the way to class, got harassed. And, you know, I can come out, I can wear my hats, I can wear my shirts, I can be open about who I am and risk losing friends, losing, you know, social capital, getting harassed, or I can simply be silent, go about my day, and not have to worry about that. And that's the choice that most people end up making.
So how do people in your position support each other in an environment like that?
I mean, it's difficult because at least when I came in, there lacked an infrastructure. But what we're trying to do is slowly do everything we can to change that. We've started to kind of organize the right a little better on campus. We've created, you know, a Facebook group for communications. We're trying to make College Republicans have a much more present and social impact on campus. So people, you know, it's not just the club to come to and talk about Trump. It's the club, you know, for basically what I want to turn College Republicans into, what I think needs to exist on all campuses is a place, and it has to be a vocal place, so that this silent majority of people who is scared to say what they believe can hear this vocal minority of people and think that, okay, you know, people are saying it, the views are out there, it's okay, you know, it's okay to come out and say this. And I've had people in high school come to me after, you know, starting the organization I started there, be like, I really would not have felt comfortable, you know, like coming out and admitting that I voted for Donald Trump, admitting that, you know, I'm a conservative, without hearing someone else do it first, without, you know, basically I've heard people say, I would not feel comfortable saying this anywhere else. But to create that environment for ideas to incubate and to kind of, I use the metaphor to bring Republicans out of the closet on campus. Because honestly, I would say it's probably much more socially damaging to come out as a Republican than come out as gay anymore. I think it's an apt metaphor.
Sure.
In the closet Republicans, it's people who just need a little push, need to know that there exists a place for them to go, a space for them to exist on this campus, and not have to make the choice between friends and philosophy, not have to make the choice between being honest with what they believe in and, you know, having a meaningful social life on campus.
Yeah, absolutely. Well said. And I think, you know, that what's really important for me too, as a libertarian, is just having some. I mean, obviously, I'm fully in favor of everybody on that campus being able to assert their beliefs and express their opinions and speak freely, regardless of their viewpoint. But having an effective challenge to the people who don't agree with me about any of that people who don't think like they think should be shut down. What I've noticed is that, you know, I came from the left. I went to college. I was one of these apathetic minds. I was heavily influenced by socialist and left-wing academics. And I left that environment thinking that I knew absolutely everything and everyone who didn't think like me was a complete fool. So I know the history behind that drives a lot of this social justice thinking. And I have less a problem with the history than I do with the philosophy. The philosophy is a mess. And so even though I agree with the history, and I think people like, you know, Zinn had some good things to say. He was also kind of using it as this social justice cover for, you know, a really bad economic agenda and what would have really been an ugly political scene as a result of those economics. But it's not like everything that he wrote was shit. And he was a really influential writer in my early development. But when you take the philosophy of the social justice movement, I think it attracts a lot of people. I don't want to say things like maladjusted or mentally ill. Those are terms I've used in the past, and I think they're a little too judgmental. But I think there is a very present mental unwellness in a lot of what shows up in these videos that we see. And I've realized that if these people continue to get what they want, even though they are a minority of people on your campus, giving them what they want by being quiet is not any kind of solution to the problem, right? Even if they get everything they want and you have to sacrifice because of that, that is still not a solution, because what I've realized is that there's always another step. And it becomes like this slippery slope. You know, the slippery slope was a logical fallacy before these people showed up, and they seem to like make it into an actual strategy.
Right, and I think the reason for that is because the philosophy that they have is just not consistent with human nature.
Right.
There's a comedian out there named Evan Syatt who has a book called The Kindergarten of Eden, which is basically exposing his philosophy, and it's the two pillars that he highlights as the main tenets are the ideas of collectivization and non-discrimination.
Right.
That people they exist in groups, that you're defined by your identity, and that nothing can be better or worse than anything else. And it's this philosophy that is inconsistent with human nature, is inconsistent with the way the world actually works, that according to Syatt leads people to invariably and inevitably always side with evil over the good, bad over the better, with basically things that are worse over things that are better, because theory goes, if everyone exists as a collective group, and if no group can be better or worse than anything else, then ultimately any inherent inequalities, any inherent differences must be the result of cheating or exploitation, and thus must be remedied.
Injustice,
oppression.
So you look
at really any major leftist issue, economics, you know, you have rich people. If no one's better or worse than anything else and there's no individuality, then therefore the rich people got rich by exploiting the poor people. Look at issues like Israel and Palestine. You know, if you look at Israel, the Israelis and the Palestinians as morally non-discriminatable people, if they are the same, if there's no collective group better or worse than the other, Israel is doing much better than Palestine right now. Israel is much more successful at the moment. Must be because of an occupation. It must be because Israel is oppressing the Palestinians, and not have to do with, you know, inherent differences in their culture, in their religion, and their philosophies. So they look at the world and they say that any instances of difference must be the result of exploitation. And the only remedy for that is to bring up the bad and to bring down the good to create this level playing field. And so that's why there's never an ending point, because the way the world actually works, there is inherently, due to the simple fact that everyone is a different individual, everyone is a unique individual. You can't be defined simply according to your identity. Everyone is important. Everyone has things that are uniquely them, and thus everyone is different, and there are naturally some things that are going to turn out better and worse. Inequality is a fact of the state of nature, and that's always going to exist. And as long as there's any sort of inequality, and not even just wealth, it's literally anything that makes you unique or different, anything that makes you an individual, is going to create inherent discrimination, because all that really means is choosing. So there's always going to be a next step. There's always going to be a victim to uphold. There's always going to be exploitation to fight against. And there's never going to be, you know, an ending point for the philosophy, because it's inconsistent with human nature.
Yeah. So I wonder like how to parse that and this will bring us to the last question, which is actually interacting with these people on campus. But I wonder how to parse that between, you know, the philosophy and the history in criticism of this way of thinking. Because, you know, there are many aspects of history that give momentum to that worldview, right? Like there is an exploitative economic history in the United States to some extent, even if you have to cherry pick for it. There is obviously a deeply racial history and an unjust one in the United States that escalated at one point. You know, there was slavery, obviously, but it escalated in the 20th century all the way to eugenics. Now, the leftists will never tell you that it was their side that was in favor of the eugenics, but there does seem to be historical arguments that stand behind the philosophy. So I'm just thinking if you're, you know, if they're talking about economics and it wanders into capitalism and before you know it, you're arguing about the age of the robber barons or child labor or something like that. It's a lot of preparation to be able to effectively counter, you know, those types of arguments. And what we learned in the 20th century is that the socialists lost. They lost the, you know, the scientific debate. They lost, the empirical debate as socialism was implemented in several places throughout the world in the 20th century. And it ended in disaster and starvation in almost every location. So it seems like the new move has been to focus on this philosophy, to not deal so much with, you know, the scientific arguments or the history, but just elevating identity over an individual's ability to actually, like, you know, interface effectively with reality and make powerful arguments. Yeah, go ahead.
I think that it also emphasizing identity and over empirical evidence serves their political purposes as well as their philosophical purposes.
Right, yeah.
Because if it's all about identity, if it's always, you know, the people are exploited because of their race, of their gender, or whatever, that gives them the opportunity to say that anyone who disagrees with me must be a bad person. If it's all oppression, anyone who doesn't support leftist policies is oppressive. Anyone who doesn't support, you know, leftist policies regarding the police must be a racist. Anyone who doesn't support leftist policies regarding healthcare must hate poor people.
Yeah.
Because it's all about identity. It's not about, you know, the most frustrating thing is whenever I talk about capitalism, someone says, wow, you just want to let people starve in the streets. I mean, no, what they don't understand is that conservatives who come out and promote capitalism, they do it because empirically capitalism is proven to be the single greatest engine to lift people out of poverty. But because that doesn't fit the leftist narrative of exploitation and collectivization, it doesn't fit the narrative of redistributing wealth, it doesn't fit the narrative of a victim class, then the left comes out and says, okay, well, you just hate poor people because these class structures exist as a facet of human nature and a facet of injustice because everyone is the same.
Right. So historical and scientific arguments are replaced with, you know, you being counseled on why you should feel ashamed of what you actually believe. Right.
Yes.
Like the metaphor that I've used before, you've played Mario Kart probably, right?
Right.
Well, when you get the lead in Mario Kart, like these people have the ideological lead in academia and the media, you can deploy little things to trip up the people who are chasing you, like oil slicks and bananas. And that's, you know, that's basically what this is. You know, you won't get a chance to go head to head in a debate with these people. They know that debating on, you know, following the rules of debate or making empirical arguments, that doesn't serve their interests.
I mean, so, it's funny you mentioned that because very recently, like this week, we had a debate scheduled and planned as well as paid for. It was supposed to be between a leading think tank expert on capitalism and a leading think tank expert on socialism. So we had signed up for the debate. It was one of Vladimir Putin's former senior economic advisors who now works for the Cato Institute.
Oh.
And the debate was canceled because after reaching out to God knows how many people, they could not find a single socialist willing to debate the person from Cato because they know if they come and debate actual economic theory, they're going to lose. Their entire argument rests on this feelings-based, moral-based attack on people who disagree with them. And it's one that's nearly impossible to counter, and one that just doesn't hold up in, you know, true scientific method testing of these ideas.
Do you know who Bob Murphy is?
Sounds familiar.
Austrian economist. By the way, great podcast you should check out. It's called Contra Krugman.
Tom Woods' podcast.
Oh, good. So you know about Tom Woods. Great. I'm excited to hear that. Awesome. Awesome. I'm excited to hear that. So Bob and Tom do this Contra Krugman podcast every week where they just take Krugman's column, which I think is in the New York Times. It certainly that seems like the right location for it. And they rip it apart. And I'm not like a deep economic thinker, and it's not even really a high area of interest to me. I've gone through all enough of the Austrian stuff, and that's pretty much my position. But even though I'm not really into economic discussions, I love this podcast, and they tear Krugman apart. But Murphy tried to get Krugman to debate him for years. He was doing like a YouTube campaign. He even raised money through like some kind of a Kickstarter program saying that he would give, I think it was ultimately like $50,000 to a charity of Krugman's choice.
And I saw that.
Yeah. And Krugman's response was like, why would I debate him? You know,
yeah, exactly.
We already won.
And that was one of the people we actually reached out to do the debate for the Capitalists was Tom Woods himself, because of this podcast.
Yeah.
And what you find is you find the people on the right are, I mean, I'm willing to go head to toe with anyone anywhere in any of these ideas, but you're not going to find people on the left willing to do that because their arguments don't hold up in debate. I mean, I think one of the best examples of this was recently, by some miracle, Bernie Sanders agreed to debate Ted Cruz over healthcare on CNN. And it was fantastic. Ted Cruz ripped him to shreds on live TV. And I don't necessarily see Bernie Sanders coming back to do that again because he was so embarrassed. But it's just proof that if you come out – I mean, the interesting was that was the first time that Bernie Sanders' ideas in the entire campaign were ever actually questioned or tested, because obviously the media is not going to do that. And when they were finally exposed to a test, 2 years, you know, after he's going around riling the country up, getting them to start believing in socialism again, the first time they were tested, they just fell apart on live TV. And it's experiences like that that show that it's one of the biggest issues that their ideas never get challenged, because they know that if they get challenged, they're going to fall apart, which is why they only, you know, Hillary Clinton's never going to appear on Fox News. They're never going to appear. Not that Fox News is the most intelligent of places, but they're not going to subject themselves to challenges their ideas in the same way that, you know, conservatives will. Whenever you see Ben Shapiro or, you know, Milo coming to campus, the idea is to go into the heart of the opposition and convince them of why they're right. You're not going to see liberals doing that because they like preaching to the choir. They like going unopposed because they know their ideas won't hold up otherwise.
Yeah, it makes me really want to do – it's, you know, when you have a podcast like this, you attract people who think like you think, and then you can talk. So I have actually started to – the more I become aware of this, the more conscious I am of the problem that I have, and a lot of people – like probably Tom Woods even has it to a certain extent, right? Like the people who are listening to Tom Woods aren't doing it because they can't stand him. And, you know, even when I go out and listen to other media, I'm trying to find things that I disagree with. You know, like I'm not on the same page on every issue with Ben Shapiro, but I love the challenge. You know, I love listening to somebody who is that smart and that good of a rhetorician say things that I don't always agree with. And there's no invitation to do that anywhere in higher education. And if you're not careful, that kind of translates to media habits as well. So I'm trying to find, you know, more people that I can bring onto my show where we can have those kinds of disagreements. Because the last thing I want is to have an echo chamber while I'm criticizing higher education for being one. But let's talk a little bit more about the social environment at Vanderbilt. Do you try to interact with, I guess, these people who are political enemies?
Sure. I mean, a lot of my friends, I'd say the majority of my friends here and back home are liberal. I don't personally care one way or the other. There's an old Jeffersonian quote, something along the lines of, I would never let politics separate me from a friend. And I subscribe to that wholeheartedly, because I keep my politics and my personal life separate, because I don't think being a liberal makes you a bad person. I don't really care if my friends are liberal or conservative. And I find that's the case for a lot of conservatives, often out of necessity due to just being in the minority. But I do find that's often not the case for liberals, that you come out and tell them you're a conservative, that you're, you know, if you're pro-life, if you voted for Trump, they will stop talking to you. They will think you're a bad person. They will get up and leave in the middle of a conversation. they'll say things like, I can't believe I'm friends with you. I can't believe that you're saying this right now. Like, and it's pervasive. It's everywhere you go and everywhere you turn. And it becomes almost a conditioned response in the sense that you just stop saying what you believe because you are conditioned to expect a negative social reaction out of it.
Do you think there's a limit, though, for, you know, maybe people who do want smaller governments or people who are more in favor of free market economics and want to see more of the complex social problems in the world solved outside of the sphere of government? Like, thinking about the whole mandatory buying of insurance under Obamacare years ago, and I was talking to liberals about that and, you know, saying, what should happen to me? What do you support happening to me? I think there are times where, you know, you can draw lines by personalizing politics. I'm not saying that every friend, you know, you have a political disagreement with, you have to say, do you support the use of violence against me? But Ben Shapiro always points out, he's the only conservative I've ever seen do it. I thought it was an exclusively libertarian thing. The gun in the room. Have you heard him use that analogy? That at the
I don't think so.
At the end of every government law is a gun, right?
Right.
I mean, that's
right.
What's backing all of this up. So, you know, one of the arguments that libertarians have made for a long time is, do you support the use of force against me to see this thing carried out, like Obamacare, for example? And I think it's a good kind of psychological test, you know, because if you personalize it that way and somebody says, oh, my God, that's real. I never thought about the system that way. I never thought about politics or law that way. Well, you know, surely there must be another solution besides me having my will imposed on you by force. You know what I mean? So I do think there are times where this is just from my experience being maybe, you know, having, I don't know, 20 years history having these types of conversations, where if you find yourself having the same conversations with the same people over and over and over again, I have found it useful, at least just for the sake of reevaluating the relationship, to draw some of those lines eventually, like to personalize it. And I do understand too, you know, the counter to what I'm saying is that most people have never thought about these things that deeply. So the first time you have a disagreement with somebody, you wouldn't want to be like, all right, this is the time that we draw a line. You know, this is the time that I put you to this psychological friendship test. I mean, it is good to be patient with people, especially people who are your age who really maybe never thought about these things too deeply. But what do you think of that idea of eventually, you know, saying, well, let's really put our cards on the table here. And, you know, what do you think should happen to me if I don't go along with these leftist policies? Because historically, we know what has happened to people who don't go along, right?
Well, I think that you're definitely right in the sense that conservatives need to do a better job of, you know, putting some emotion behind our arguments, you know, putting that personal touch on it. I think it's just a you know, result of how our philosophies think. Conservatives are all about empiricism. It's about looking at what has worked and what will work. So it's much more factual and logical. And then liberals are about victimization, collectivization. And so they're more about feelings. It's a facts versus feelings dynamic. And unfortunately, with a lot of way human psychology works, feelings are going to win that argument. So I think conservatives 100% need to get better with feelings. As far as the idea of the government being a use of force kind of institution, that's an argument I use a lot in talking to people. I'd be like, talking about taxes, I'd be like, would you put a gun to my head and take $50,000 from me to go feed the poor? And a lot of people say no, but a lot of people surprisingly would say yes. They would say that if you refuse to help people, you know, get the healthcare they need, if, you know, the one you hear a lot is you just let someone die there on the streets. Obviously not. No conservative, I think, if they saw someone dying on the streets, would be like, he doesn't have health insurance. Let's just leave him there.
Right.
I don't know anyone who would advocate for that. And trying to explain the difference between coercive force, trying to explain the difference between, you know, voluntary charity and associations and individual mandates, it kind of often goes over people's heads, as you were saying, because they don't have an exposure to the non-aggression principle. They don't understand the philosophical underpinnings of what a government is and should be. So they look at the government as an agent of social change as opposed to an institution that exists to protect rights. And they look at it as kind of the aggregate of the interests of the citizens. And thus, if the government is doing something, it must be because the citizens support it. So if you Right. oppose government action, that makes you a bad person, because obviously your interests must be in terms of letting the person starve, letting the person die in the streets. It's because you're a bad person, not because you believe in a fundamental difference between coercive force and voluntary association. But they don't have the philosophical underpinnings to understand that for the most part. And so they just resort to you're a bad person, because for a lot of them, it just flies right over their heads. The fact is that more Republicans give to charity than Democrats, at a higher percentage. We donate more. And, you know, I don't know how disparate the numbers are, but that comes from a fact of what they don't understand is Republicans, conservatives are not bad people. We don't want to let people starve. We just don't believe it should be done with a gun to the head. And that's a distinction that, because of their understanding of what government is and should be, that I think they often have trouble making.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So just to clarify my last question, even though all of that was great, we're all friends with like the democratic drifters, right? The people who've just kind of drifted that way, maybe they're just not that interested in politics or political Sure. philosophy. So yeah, whatever. I mean, I know people like that. Have you ever tried to engage with the more warrior types on your campus?
Or, oh, 100%.
Yeah.
I think that's the fun stuff, honestly. And you don't go into a debate like that expecting to change minds, obviously. You go into a conversation like that. For me, it's a conversation of learning. It's trying to understand what they think, to understand how to better oppose it. And it's a conversation that's directed towards the third party more than person you're talking to. It's a conversation where you have to pick the right words to expose the other side, so that the drifters who are listening can have really like an internalized understanding of what you are saying. So when, you know, I have conversations with social justice warriors, when there's arguments with them, you're not speaking to them, you're speaking through them to a larger audience. And remembering that distinction, not trying to change their minds, but trying to, you know, expose their logic as faulty. I think it's a lot of fun, and I think that it's also one of the best ways to really start putting question into the drifters' minds, that, you know, blindly following this other group of warrior militant activists is probably not the best idea.
Really well said. I used to have this Democrat that I would argue with all the time, and if he would start with me, I'd say, I won't do this not in front of an audience. I will only do this in front of an audience, right? Because Right. it's once you know, for whatever reason, the person that you're talking directly to is not reachable right now, it has to be an exercise worth your time. And it does involve those people who might be more apathetic, who do have that tendency to drift there as observers, to actually be able to compare the two sides of the argument, and maybe that influences them your way. I think that's really important. So anything particularly acrimonious involving you and one of these people or several of these people?
I wouldn't say so. Not really, since I've been at Vanderbilt. Like, I can't think of a specific instance when I've, you know, gotten into it heavily with one of these people. I'm sure there will be in the future. I would say it's more of a kind of a general attitude about it. There's also, unfortunately, not much of a forum for stuff like that to take place.
Sure. Yeah.
Just because of, you know, the nature of an apathetic school, and we were trying to do that. We tried to set up that capitalism versus socialism debate. We could find a socialist to do it. And we work to try and create these forums, but they don't always exist. I think the more important work comes less with directly engaging with the militant left and more with, you know, bringing the closeted right out. It's speaking past the opposition and going directly towards the people who agree with you and are too scared to admit it. Because I think that's the best agent to to bring change. It's the most likely place for it to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's one of the most unfortunate parts of higher education, is that it really stifles out an entire philosophy. It's a philosophy that I've, you know, dedicated a lot of my life to. It's a philosophy I'd like to see continue. And the fact that people are just scared of it, I think is very unfortunate. I think that's the main fight. Less so than changing minds, it's changing that internal debate to allow people to, you know, come out and be open about things. Because once that's taken care of, then it'll get much easier to engage the other side, because you have an equal playing field, you have similar agents of support, and you have more people who would come out and be interested in it. And it creates more of a social environment to it that allows for, you know, the frictions to actually manifest. But until, you know, you have that equal playing field, until you bring conservatives out of the closet, it's much more difficult to go in and actually equally, you know, rub heads with the other side.
Yeah, but once that situation is created, you do really and finally have a forum in which the best ideas can win, you know, fairly by the rules of reason and reality. You know, and I think that that's a place that we really need to get to, even
right.
if we're not on the same page on every
issue. That's
really
important to have.
Yeah.
I think that's another thing that separates conservatives and liberals, is that we want our ideas to be out there in that forum. We want them to be tested. We don't want to go to a conservative college where everyone's going to agree with us, because then we would, you know, be lousy proponents of our ideas. We want this place to exist, but they don't, because their ideas won't uphold it. And so the first fight is getting to the forum. And then once we get to the forum, I think it's easy from there, because our ideas are, you know, more correct.
Less dangerous.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sure.
And I think that's important, too, because a lot of people in my audience are kind of they find the word conservative off-putting, because a lot of us became politically aware, like during the presidency of, you know, George W. Bush. You know, that was just a tremendous mess. A lot of people don't like the alliance that was forged with the religious right in the early 1980s as a way to get votes. So, you know, again, there's a difference between practices and principles. And even if people don't agree in my audience with conservatives on every social issue, I know I certainly don't, there is an alliance here where people do really support free speech, you know, especially outside of the realm of politics. Like once you start talking about politicians, I mean, you know, who really knows what they want? But there are a lot of us who want, you know, open forums, free speech, and free exchange of ideas. And I think that that's worth something, you know, coming together on. And
yeah.
Yeah, good.
I mean, I think there's a lot of friction in the circles of the right. I mean, I'm more libertarian myself, but I you know people who are more socially conservative. There's the hawks, there's non-interventionists, there's all these frictions in the right which are real and important. But I think fundamentally what the real struggle is, it's not about conservative, libertarian, Republican, Democrat, any of these things. It's about individualists versus the collectivists.
Right.
That is the fundamental division. That is the fundamental struggle. It's about freedom and individuality versus collectivization and government control. And all these other social issues, sure, they're great to debate, but it's that fundamental division that's important. And it's regardless of what your opinion is on abortion or gay marriage is, everyone who believes in individual rights must stick together and fight from a unified front, because otherwise we're going to lose.
Yeah.
So I don't, you know, and I also think that a lot of the social conservatives, at least nowadays, it's a personal choice. You know, I'm a libertarian, so I could not care less if you support or oppose gay marriage. And I know most people nowadays, at least, who oppose gay marriage, at least from college perspective, they say, I don't believe in gay marriage. That doesn't support my religious convictions, but it's my job to tell you how to exercise your marriage. And it's not the government's job to even have any say in marriage whatsoever, because it's a religious church-based issue. And so right. You have these social – not social liberals, social libertarians who have – basically what they say is – and this is what I subscribe to – is that my own personal views on these issues don't matter. And I think that attitude of toleration towards other social views is hugely important to bring the country together. And I think that the first step in that is bringing the right together and saying, you know, listen, social conservatives, there's these libertarians who like to smoke pot and want gays to get married. Listen, libertarians, there's social conservatives who, you know, might have their own hesitations about, you know, the direction in which this society and this country is going. That's well and good. That doesn't matter. We all believe in individual rights, and there's this menace of socialism, this menace of collectivism on the other side. We have to come together. We have to stand together and fight that as a unified front. That's the only way that we're going to get to a point where we can even debate these other issues.
Yeah, that's really well said. That's exactly my thinking. Like, let's deal with the people who might like to see us in gulags, and I don't think I'm being super hyperbolic there. Right. I mean, it will get to that. This thing has a, you know, an accelerating nature. And then once that problem is solved, yeah, then we can split back up and we can debate social issues. We can debate foreign policy issues. Once, if we are all honestly on the same page about wanting an honest forum in which we can do it, right? Which the left obviously doesn't want. So once, you know, that is taken care of, you know, then we could maybe actually have the debates that, you know, can move the world in the right direction. So
yeah, I know. Yeah, I agree with that 100%.
So, you know, one benefit, Sam, of the way things are right now, especially in higher education, is that people like yourself, and I thought you were a great example of this today, get really polished in your thinking and your communication, you know, conservatives and libertarians, because it's like an all-out attack against that way of thinking. So that's one thing that I think we should try to help people who might feel frustrated in these situations realize, and you should try to take advantage of it, even if the situation can be frustrating sometimes. What do you think?
Oh, 100%. I mean, I undoubtedly, if I didn't grow up in the Bay Area, if I didn't live in a liberal family, go to a liberal school, go to a liberal university, I would never have discovered the passion I have for these issues. I would never have gotten as polished, as educated as I am now. If I just simply, you know, grew up believing what my parents believed. And I think it was I'm grateful to have had that opportunity to really have, you know, my ideas tested, you know, in the lion's den, because I think that has emerged me as a much more informed, educated, and well-rounded thinker. A lot of the luxuries that a lot of my opponents maybe don't have due to growing up in an echo chamber.
Yeah.
I think that's a unique silver lining of this issue. I think it's something that for the people who have the ability to use that gymnasium, it's critical that they exercise it. Because when you go on into the world, it's going to turn those of us who went through these, you know, indoctrination factories and survived into much better advocates, much better leaders in the future. And I think it's important to take advantage of that for sure.
Absolutely. Not to mention the fact that some people who have not had access to that gymnasium, most of your political science professors.
Oh, yeah. No, 100%. They get to the position of being tenured faculty, listening to people who agree with them and regurgitating that, as opposed to having to fight their way through it and emerge a more weathered and successful opinionated person.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Sam, thank you so much for your time. And I wish you the best of luck in the conclusion of your freshman year.
Awesome. Thank you so much for the opportunity. Everyone is helpful, everyone is kind, on the road to Shambhala. Everyone is lucky, everyone is so kind, on the road to Shambhala. Oh, shine.